The American people will soon find out if the United States is going to war.
Fires are raging across Brazil's Amazon rainforest.
At the stroke of midnight, the U.S. hit China with tariffs on $34 billion worth of goods.
Hurricane Dorian made landfall with wind speeds of 185 miles per hour.
Multiple drones bombed Saudi Arabia's largest oil facilities today.
60,000 people have fled their homes in northeastern Syria.
It's like these 500-year floods or 100-year floods. They're happening every other year.
Anti-government protesters in Hong Kong have taken to the streets.
The magnitude 7.1 quake was felt from Los Angeles all the way to Nevada.
It is one of the worst escalations of violence on the Israel-Gaza border in years.
The world seems so unstable, so insecure. Everything is changing way too fast. But there are some things that are steadfast, things that never change. God and His Word. Randy Reams is pastor of Kindred Bible Church in Nampa, Idaho. Join Pastor Randy now as he shares truths from God's unchanging Word.
We are in Esther, but again, let me lay the groundwork what I went through with the kids, because we had to split the story in half last week. But before we do, 2 weeks ago, we began in the book of Ezra. And the middle of the book of Ezra has a gap between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of about 70 years. It is in that gap the story Esther takes place. So as we began last week, Ahasuerus is what it says in your Bible. The Greek translation of that is Xerxes. That's how most of us know Xerxes, okay? And so that would be, you see up on the screen, is the size of the Achaemenid, or we would call the Persian Empire, during Xerxes' reign. That right there, you see the borders I just put in black? That's what we know today as the country of Iran. So I put that on there so you get a context about where that is. The story begins, we learned last week, at the citadel, the palace, and so on, at Susa, which today is right there with the city of Shush, Iran. Okay? Right along the river. I want you to understand that covers about 2.1 million square miles. About 49.4 million people, the archaeologists and those who know more than I do, estimate lived in that space. About 44% of what was then the world's population was under the rule of King Xerxes. That's a heaps a lot of people. There in Shush today, by the way, is the tomb of Daniel. There are some places people argue, but most archaeological people and Bible scholars and non-Bible scholars believe this is the tomb of Daniel. Okay, now, to be honest, it is surrounded by city now, all right? That tall spire right there, and Muslims today go there and do prayers and various religious. This is the inside. Look at that. I'm doing this on purpose. I think that's probably cut glass. I'm not sure that you're seeing all over this the ceiling there. Okay, you can see up the very center of the interior of the tomb of Daniel there in Shush. That's the actual sarcophagus, I guess, is what you say. And if you can go online and see videos of this, and you'll see Muslims kissing it and praying there, that kind of thing. Okay, see if I'm going the right way. Now, this picture, I used this picture. I know it's an old black and white taken in 1937 because the city's not all grown around it now. So over there to your far left at the top is the palace and what is the Great Hall that is spoken of in this story, where Xerxes is having a banquet in the first half of the book for 180 days with his generals. And civically, he is planning his war against the Greek alliance. He spends 3 to 4 years doing that. That's where that first banquet starts out. Well, Vashti won't come to the banquet. It's happening over there, and we'll talk about the Acropolis over here. That's the temple stuff would be over here. But down at the bottom, you can see the spire. That's where Daniel's tomb is. But now it's right up against it. I just wanted you to see it from back then. Behind the Acropolis would have been the royal city where the folks lived, most of the folks lived at that time. That castle you see there, that was built by the French. just few before this, okay? Because they were the ones who were doing the archaeology there. That castle you see in the middle is not part of the original, what we would call the Persian Empire. So that's the remains of it today. See the castle? So when you were looking at it before, you were looking over there where the city is, where all the people is. You're sort of looking at it from that direction. So this is the foundation of the palace, okay, and the Abdana, or the Great Hall. So they could measure this and know how big it is and all that. There was one just like it, which I've shown you pictures of before, in what's called Persepolis, which is further south and east. The one there is very preserved. Alexander did not destroy it as much as he did this one, but they're almost identical. And there are a picture today I'll show you of Xerxes engraven on a wall, okay, that came from there. But we can look at this. Those deep holes you see towards this end were rooms for officials. And down here towards the bottom right of your screen was the place for the harem. Would that come into play into this story? Okay. And then there's a long hallway that went over to the palace, which would be on your far right. Eventually, Artaxerxes' son, builds a palace across the river. Just to give you a show, this is stuff they've dug up, taken off the stuff there. That's pretty colorful stuff. I mean, all we see today is, you know, old mud bricks and things like that. But in their day, and these are all in various museums, okay? And these are just some Persian archermen. A unicorn Pegasus thing. But again, you can see the color. And the reason why I do that is because I want to also show you some artist renditions of the Abadana. And they're based upon colors they see. They've taken off this. And when they compare these two particular halls that they had. Okay? So, as we talked about this the last week, that first part of the Book of Esther takes place where they have the grand meeting. Vashti doesn't show up. Xerxes' advisor says, dump Vashti, get a new queen. During that time, Xerxes goes to war against the Greek city-states. That war that you've heard of, the Battle of Thermopylae, the movie The 300, I don't recommend it by any stretch, okay? I'm not saying that. But the Great Battle of Thermopylae and others, he eventually sacks Athens. Hey, we're winning this war. He goes home late in the year. When he gets back, his advisor says, hey, you need to pick your queen, and this beauty contest begins, okay? So Hadassah, that's Esther's Hebrew name. She's quite amazing. The Bible says she has good form, shape, figure, and facial looks, right? Her cousin Mordecai has been raising her. Her parents have died. She gets favor with the head eunuch, all right? Things are looking good for her. She's going to end up winning the contest, all right? But Mordecai, in worrying for her, goes at the king's gate, is that next? No, I need to show you. That is, remember, these pillars that hold up this hall, okay, are 62 feet high. This is the top, you can see the person back there, and you can see some of those images from that museum, right? But you can see the person, that's just the top portion that the beams of the roof of the Great Hall set on. Okay, that's just the very top of it. So you'll see it in some of the artist renditions. Okay, again, there's a broken one of these there in Susa, but in Persepolis further south and east, there's some of them still standing. How do you know they're that tall? Because they're still standing. Okay, the bases were a little different. Okay, there you go. That's an artist rendition of the King's Gate. Mordecai spent every day is at the king's gate wanting to get word about Esther and how it is going. While there, he hears to the eunuchs that man the gate that they're plotting to kill Xerxes in an assassination attempt. He gets the word passed on to Esther. Esther passes on to Xerxes. They do an investigation. Yep, they're guilty. They kill the guys. Okay? And actually tells us those guys' name, Bigthana and Teresh are the two guys' names. It actually tells us that, all right, in the process. The antagonist of our story appears here, Haman. As like we talked about last time, he is of the heritage from the family line, descendants of the king Agag of the Amalekites that Saul was supposed to kill, then he didn't. Mordecai happens to be a descendant of Benjamite, the same as Saul. Okay, so we talked about last time, this whole problem shows up because Saul doesn't obey God. 1,000 years earlier, about. But Mordecai won't bow to Haman when Haman's elevated to prime minister. We'll call it that. He's given the signet ring of Xerxes. He won't bow. All right, this bothers Haman immensely. And Haman goes to King Xerxes and says, hey, you know there's these people. Because Xerxes gave the law, you have to bow to Haman. There's these people, a people group, that won't obey your laws. He doesn't give details. He just says there's this group that doesn't obey. Can you believe? I mean, I'm so behind this of stopping this. And he goes to put up a bunch of money to the king to get him to pass some law that would cause the Jewish people to come to demise. But again, Xerxes isn't told what group of people. Xerxes does like many people in authority do. He delegates, says, here's my ring. You write the law. Sounds good to me. He writes the law. The decree goes throughout the kingdom. And he just, it's in 11 months is when we're going to kill all the Jews. Mordecai hears about this, passes the message to Esther. Esther says, but I can't do a bunch of it. You can't just walk into the king's that big, huge hall and just walk in there. If you haven't been invited by the king, you're dead meat. That's my paraphrase. Okay, and that's where that famous line where Haman says to Esther, perhaps you were born for such a time as this. Maybe all your wonderful beauty and all that blessing you have, God gave you for such a time as this. So when that basically brings us to chapter 6. So we are going to read chapter 6 together. So Esther, chapter 6, when you get there, please stand. It is our tradition to stand for the reading of God's word. Oh, I got to back up. I've jumped ahead a little bit. I forgot to tell you, this is also the part where she does go in. Forgive me. She does go in, and the king, I might have a slide of that too. No, I'll have to go back. Shoot. The scepter that they had was not like you've seen something in the Ten Commandments, and I can't control it anymore. Okay, the Ten Commandments, in short, it's actually a staff. I have a picture up here, a full staff, and he would lean it towards you if you got favor. So that's where you heard me tell the kids, what do you want? Have a banquet. Has the banquet. Mordecai goes home and brags about his 10 sons, about his riches, about he is just so special. Sorry for bypassing that. That brings us to chapter 6. Okay? During the night, this is between the two banquets. So it's the night before the second banquet. During the night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had reported what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigtha and Teresh, the two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor and dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's servants who attended him said, man, nothing has been done for him. So the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman just happened to enter the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said to him, behold, Haman is standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in. The king said to him, what is to be done for a man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring the royal robe which the king has worn. the horse which the king has ridden, and on whose head the royal crown has been placed. Let the robe and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's nobles, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him. But they take a long time to say something, don't they? Okay. And lead him on horseback through the city its square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. And the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai, the Jew. Do notice that the king knew that Mordecai was Jewish, who is sitting at the king's gate. And he happens to know where Mordecai is sitting as well. Okay? Do not fall short anything of all that you had said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done for the man whom the king desires to honor. And then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman returned home mourning, with his head covered, embarrassed and ashamed. In other words, Haman encountered Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends. And everything had happened to him. And when his wise men and his wife said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. You may be seated. One thing you do need to notice, the king knows that Mordecai sits at the king's gate. That means he's Jewish people, probably, are coming to him. He is an elder. He's sitting at the gate, and they come and get judgments or advice and counsel from him. All right? So I'm not sure why, but God's perfect timing. When Esther throws the first banquet, she doesn't reveal Haman's plot then. Okay? God, in his infinite providence, okay, which I'll explain in a minute, okay, make sure that Haman's building the gallows before Esther exposes him. This is an artist's rendition, by the way, of that great hall. This is actually almost that there was relief carvings on the front stairs there are right out of Propolis. All right, there is an engraving on one of the side stairs of Xerxes and his dad Darius, which hopefully I can get there. There you go. Another artist's rendition of the hall. We are a visual people in our culture today. We don't read books unless they have pictures. Okay? As a culture. So I'm trying to get you the image, the majesty, the magnificent of the surroundings where all this is taking place. That's another artist's rendition, as if you were standing out looking at the entrance of that. I mean, there's all kinds of people have made these, all right? So I just wanted you to get that imagery in your head. This is, again, one artist's rendition of that throne. At one end of the hall, you can go there, they've dug it up. There's a risen part where the king's throne is, and you'd come in all the way down at the far end of the hall that seats 5,000 people. Okay, according to today's occupancy load standards allowed in America, they might have crammed more in that end. You got to come way down there at the other end. So I think the Idaho Center seats about 5,000, doesn't it? More than that? Okay. But that's a big place. So she's going to enter at the far end. Well, he's down here at this end, sitting on his throne, doing judgments. That's what kings do, making decisions. On the throne is Darius, Xerxes' dad, father, and standing behind the throne with his hand up next to the throne there, that's Xerxes. I didn't make that up. The archaeologists tell me that. But I put that green bar there. That's the staff you see. And all of these, of that period of time, the Persian kings had this long staff. So I did that to show you. It wasn't a stick like this and, you know, maybe like the Catholic guy sprinkles water on you or something. Okay? It's a staff. And he leans that staff forward to acknowledge you, to make sure you can come into the presence of the king. All right, and that's it. So I wanted you to get a picture in your head where this is happening. Esther's walked into this grand hall in front of all these people and invited the king to a banquet. You got to understand the irony of this. This whole story starts with the king having a banquet that the queen won't show up at. Now the queen is inviting the king to a banquet. Does he go, no, I ain't going to show? Didn't he get rid of a woman for that? No, God couldn't be in vasty stubbornness, could he? No, he couldn't. No, it's not possible. So she walks in there, makes this plea. They go to that first banquet. He asks her, well, what are you up to? Half your kingdom. Just come to another dinner tomorrow night. Now, I've heard preachers say Esther got cold feet, got a little afraid. I believe in God's providence that this message is about, that he's working out. He's going to make sure that Haman's building his own gallows. So again, Haman goes home, brags to his wife and his friends. He brags about his 10 sons, his wealth, how he's got a special place with the king. I mean, look at, I even had dinner with the king and the queen. And you think about that. And I don't care what party you're from. If the president and your wife said, why don't you come over to the White House and have dinner if they're here in the private residence, you'd probably talk about that. No matter which party you're from. Okay, or the queen or whoever you see that way. So I understand that, but his pride's part of the problem to begin with. Well, he's home doing all that boasting and stuff. Okay, his friends and his wife, good advice. Why don't you go build this big gallows to hang this guy on? And it's 50 cubits, which is about 75 feet high. So he doesn't want to kill him. He wants to show off the fact that he's killing him. Why? Because then everybody else will bow to him when he comes through. You got to understand, if you don't bow to me, I'm showing you, I'm setting an example here. There's no reason to build a 75-foot gallows, folks. Okay? So we get high enough for everybody to see it. This goes on, and during the night, the king's trying to sleep. It just so happens that's the night he can't sleep. He could blame it on the meal that I guess Esther cooked for him or whatever. Okay? But he can't sleep. So what will put you sleep faster than the court records? Now, my son's a lawyer. Trust me, you do not want to read those court records. When he was in law school, he was writing these papers and he'd send them home and Kim would proof them and I'd read, so not as much as she did, and they could put you to sleep. So he said, hey, I need to go to sleep. So let's just read something that's going to be monotone, right? And it just so happens, again by accident, that when the servant heads off to the royal library, how many scrolls are in that royal library? All the ones from his dad. And the ones before, Darius the Great and so on. Just so happens that the guy picks that scroll, comes in and starts reading. Yeah, hey, there was this guy named Mordecai. He comes in and these guys were plotting to kill you and he exposed the plot and saved your life and all of a sudden, he's not falling asleep anymore. Wait, hey, that's right. Did we ever do anything to thank that guy? Well, in the meantime, Haman's left home. He's traveling to the palace. He's clueless. The king was there. No, we've never done anything for him, says the servant. Wow. Is there anybody in the court this time of night? Just so happens. Yeah, Haman's out there. Now, I want you to imagine this. He's in his bedroom trying to sleep. Haman now gets invited into the king's royal bedroom. You got to be thinking you're all that and a bag of chips. You know what I mean? I mean, he was pretty big-chested, but he's been invited in the king's private residence. So what do you expect him to think when the king says, hey, what do you think someone should do for somebody the king really wants to honor? Notice the type of honor that Haman seeks. Because he thinks it's him, which is understandable. I know he's a jerk, okay, in our story. But I understand when you got invited into the king's private residence, you might think that's you. But he doesn't say, you know what? Add a wing onto my palace or his house. Or, give me retirement for the rest of my life. Or guarantee my children, my 10 sons are taken care of after I'm gone. No, he wants public praise. Okay, I'm going to be frank. Some big, you know, Warren Buffett or somebody's got all this money and says, man, what do you want up to half my wealth or whatever it is? How do you want? I wouldn't be asking for public praise. Matter of fact, I'd rather he kept it quiet. Okay. And there's put the robe on, king's horse, take him through the city square, bragging on the guy. Good idea, Haman. Go do that for Mordecai. I want you to think about that a minute. You've been called into the boss's office. You've been doing a great, you're ready. It's going to be a raise. Yeah. I want you to go out and tell the guy you've been working with all the time. Tell him he's been promoted. Okay. I could just imagine him pulling that horse through the city square. Now, don't think of city square, you know, like a roundabout. Okay, in those days, the city squares were Red Square, Moscow, you know, where the troops would display. They're huge, okay? Just, look at the king when he likes you, what he does. Come on. I know you always rejoice when the other guy gets the blessing. I'm sure you do. It never bothers you. Goes home, talks to his family, talks to his wife. Dude, you're in trouble now. That's my paraphrase again. Okay. While this is going on, eunuchs show up to take him to the next banquet. They're having the banquet. Esther's, you know, the third time he says, girl, what do you want? Whatever you want. Now I want you to understand this. Xerxes is not a nice guy. Read history. He was brutal. A mixed crowd here, children. I'm not going into how he treated his enemies. Okay? How he treated slaves and so on. He wasn't a nice guy. So it wasn't just within his nature to go, I'm going to be nice. Okay? It was the favor that God showed to Esther. Excuse me. And so that's when Esther says, man, I'd really like it if my people weren't wiped off the face of the earth. Let me put it another way. I'd really like it if Gaza would stop shooting 4,000 missiles at us. Yeah, I said that. Okay? What do you mean? What do you mean they're going to kill your people? Yeah, Haman here's got this plot and this king's so angry. You heard me tell the kids. He is so angry. I mean, most kings immediately, off of his head. No. He's so angry, he steps out of the room. Out into the garden. I love it. Just when he goes back in, Haman is throwing himself on the couch. Now that means the pillows. Esther's laying back on these pillows. And Haman's throwing himself right there. And that just happens to be when Xerxes walks back in. Dude! You mean, while I'm in the palace, you're going to do this? Okay? And now realize the eunuch in the room isn't supposed to speak unless spoken to. Dude, he's been watching this. Probably from all the way back in this story. He was probably maybe one of the eunuchs that took the place of the other guys that got killed after a plot. Can I say something? Did you know in this plot that Haman built a 75-foot gallows outside his house? He doesn't say hang him on it. That's all he says. He knows where Xerxes wants to go with it. Oh, okay, that works for me. Hang him on it. Okay? As you go on in the story, all right, Esther asked, what are we going to do about this law that was passed under Haman's plot? Because when a king in Persian Empire made a law, it couldn't be revoked. So the king has taken his ring from Haman and now gives it to Mordecai and gives Haman's estate to Esther, who puts Mordecai in charge of it. He's got the king's signet ring on now, and the king says, I'm not sure how to deal with this. Like he did the first time that got him in a bunch of trouble. You guys fix it. Okay? So one of the ways they fix this is Mordecai writes a law. Number one, the right to assembly, even in COVID. The right to defend their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate an entire army or anyone, people, or province that attack them. And they have the right to the spoils. Now look it, they couldn't change the law that these people were going to try to kill the Jews. But they wrote a law that the Jews can fight back. You see what I'm saying? Right? And they had the right to the spoils. Now, the story tells us they don't take the spoils when the people do attack them to kill them. And they kill the people, including St. Haman's 10 sons, a total of 75,000 people. As we read on in the next chapter, 75,000 people. They don't take the spoils. They had the right to by the law, but they don't take the spoils. Okay? So I want to talk to you about two doctrinal truths today. Don't let the word doctrine scare you. The word doctrine just means teaching. Okay? So Christian doctrines, the first one is called the doctrine of God's divine providence. Okay? That is God's sovereign, omniscient, all-knowing, complete governance over the universe and the affairs of humanity. God governs all that is. As R.C. Sproul put it this way, if there's one molecule in the universe outside God's governance and control, God's not sovereign at all. Okay? So it's God's governance, and I'm using that term, that he governs over all those things. Okay? So let me give you a few scriptures. Psalms 135 and 6. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. In heaven, on earth, in the sea, and in all the depths. Just so you don't leave a place out. Okay? Ephesians 1 and 11. That he, God, works all things after the counsel of his will. Okay? All things go according to God's plan. That's my paraphrase. But this works with something called the doctrine of concurrence. I know, and some of you say, I never heard that before. I will read to you a definition because it said, well, there I could stumble through it, but I'll read to you my definition. It is God's active causal activity in producing everything that occurs. That is, unless God causally produces the events in the world, the secondary causes could not produce those effects. Huh? Well, let me tell you, there's three ways God does this. One's miracles. He parts the Red Sea. Walks on water. Doesn't happen that often, folks. But the other way to do it is natural laws. Now, if you remember science, and we did this on Wednesday night, by the way, I could put the formula up there for what gravity, define gravity. But you know they don't know what gravity is? They don't know why gravity has a force. You got the, you guys, oh, please, don't fade out on me now. You remember you did chemistry in high school, and you had an atom. You had the protons, positive charge in the middle. Remember that? Neutral ones in there, neutrons, and then the electrons. Remember that? Positive, electrons are negative. What should these do? Correct? Opposites attract. We don't know why, but I put it magnetic fields. Why doesn't an atom collapse? There's these things they call the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force. It's just the way they say, we don't know, it does this. Here's one of God's concurrence. If God doesn't actively sustain the laws of nature, they will not continue to be laws. Okay? Every atom would collapse. Gravity would cease. The laws of thermodynamics and motion and all those other things you slept through science class in would stop working if God didn't sustain them. Okay? 1 Corinthians 8 and 6. For us, there is but one God, the Father, from who are all things, and we exist for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. Acts 17 and 28, first part of that verse, in him we live and move and have our being. In case you don't know, your being's made up of atoms. Just thought I'd tell you. Okay, that's not the guy in Genesis. Hebrews 1, 3. And he, that is the Son, is the radiance of his, that is God's, glory, the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. Colossians chapter 1, 15 through 17. And he, the Son, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him are all things were created, both in heavens and on earth, visible and invisible. Let me put it this way. Strong, weak nuclear force, magnetic force, gravitational force. Visible or invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He holds the atoms of the universe together. That's one of the ways the doctrine of concurrence, how God's will gets done when it begins to interact with creation, one of the ways that is done is through the laws of nature. Right? Man, and the earth was exceedingly wicked in everything they did. I think I'll send rain. He used a natural force, correct? Plagues in Egypt, natural forces. Okay? Because God uses natural forces, many people want to say those aren't miracles. I'm not going into that. But the other thing he does to bring about his will through concurrence, his interaction, how his will and this interaction down here in the created world is through people. That's where we really get messed up. Okay? Because here's why. A guy is in talking to the king who can't sleep. And the king says, hey, would you go get something for me to read? And he walks into this room over here and he chooses what's going to get read. Of his own free will, he decides which scroll to pick. But it's the exact scroll that God willed that he would pick. Did God come down, make us grab his hand, force him over there? No. Concurrence is, that doctrine of concurrence deals with this idea. We're not going into completely deeply today, but I've got you that example. Matter of fact, Wednesday night when we happen to be doing this, we're going through what we believe, okay, our statements of faith, and we talk about God being creator, sustainer, preserver of all things, and we got into this, okay? But let's remember the story of Joseph. It's one of the prime examples of God's providence and concurrence, okay? Remember? Joe's dad likes him a lot, makes him a special coat. His brothers don't like it. They get jealous, right? They sell him off to slavery. He goes to Egypt. Man, this is a short paraphrase. While in Egypt, he gets bought by a guy named Potiphar, whose wife falsely accuses him of other things. He gets thrown in prison. While in prison, he meets a couple guys, interprets their dreams. One of them goes back and works for Pharaoh. Eventually, when Pharaoh has a dream, the cupbearer says, hey, I know this guy, interprets dreams. Come on, you all seen, at least you've seen the animated version, right? Okay. Eventually, his brothers, if you remember, have to come to Egypt for a famine. Let me say this again, a famine. The laws of nature. God is using the laws of nature to cause Joseph's brothers to come to him to get food. Just accidentally. So all those things that got Joseph where he was just... God just watched, saw it sort of kind of happen. He says, geez, I wonder if I can do anything with this. I'm being sarcastic. Okay? So when he meets his brothers again in Genesis 45 and 5, Joseph speaking to his brothers, I believe, and now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves for what they had done, because you sold me here, for God sent me here before you. Wait a minute. They sold him. God didn't. But God sent me. Wait a minute. You know what? These guys were sinning when they sold him. Remember, God didn't come down and grab them and make him sold. He's not the author of sin. He doesn't tempt with sin. But he knows human nature. Okay? Verse 8. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on the earth, the remnant of Jewish people, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me father to Pharaoh, Lord of all this house and ruler over Egypt. I understand you made choices and decisions on your own, but ultimately God had a plan. Okay? Then in Genesis 50 and 20, here's what he says, Joseph says to them. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. Notice this. He doesn't say God used it for good. No, he said God meant it for good. You had a motive in what you did. You had a sinful motive. God didn't. Now, I want you to go back a long ways to a guy named Abraham. Abraham gets promised by God to have children like the stars of the sky, the sand of the sea, and he gives him one. Right? But he says, look it, before your people are going to possess the land, which we know of Israel, all that area today, before that happens, these people that are living there, their wickedness hasn't got as wicked as it's going to get yet. And I want to judge them when they get really wicked. So your descendants are going to become slaves in Egypt. Can I go without that promise, God? Can we just skip that part? Now, wait a minute. That promise is being fulfilled through these brothers and Joseph. That's how the Hebrews end up in Egypt to begin with. So this just isn't Joe and his brothers. This is part of God's plan from way back at Abraham. And I know y'all had the wrong motive, but God never does. Okay? Psalms reaffirms this and says the same thing, that God sent a man ahead of them, that is Joseph, who was... So he affirms that it was God. If we go to Acts chapter 4, listen to verse 27 and 28. Listen to the people listed here. Truly, this city, Jerusalem, they were gathered together against your holy servant, Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod, Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. He's talking about here in Jerusalem during the Passion Week. Passion Week, that is the suffering of Christ, that week. Herod, Pilate, the Gentiles, and the Jewish leaders, you appointed that they do whatever your hand, God, your plan, God, had destined them to take place. Did any of those people do anything good from our perspective? The Gentiles crucified him. Pilate convicted an innocent man. Herod mocked him. And the Jews killed him. But one of them pleaded for him to be killed. That wasn't money, but he did anything right there. But wait a minute. God had a plan. And I'm going to tell you that plan was done well before he ever said, let there be light. He had that plan. And I'm going to go through these fast. Job, you guys know the story of Job? The Bible says that the angels are reporting to God. The spirits, whatever you want to call them, are reporting to God. They got to give a report to God. Satan's there. Like God doesn't know. Hey, Satan, what you been doing? I've been paying attention, see. Oh, roaming to and fro on the earth. Yeah. Hey, you ever took note of my servant named Job? You ever seen him? Oh, him! Well, yeah, of course he serves you, right? Because you bless him. Yeah. What do you think he wouldn't serve me if he wasn't blessed? Yeah, you stop blessing him. You remove your hand from him. Let me get to his stuff, and he'll curse you. Whose idea was that? God's idea, have you considered my servant Job? Satan wasn't thinking about him. Okay? Then it tells us, though, that the Sabaeans come along and they steal and kill. The Chaldeans come along, steal and kill. And a great wind comes along and knocks houses down. Now, wait a minute. Satan's the one who's been given charge of this task. So where did the great wind come from? Okay? Now, God had a plan, but he used people, the greed of the Sabaeans to come steal, the hate of the Chaldeans to kill. All right? He used those things. In 1 Kings, Ahab is a wicked king in the northern kingdom of Israel. We covered this story. And God's going, man, I got to do something about this Ahab. You know, if he'd attack these people up there, they could wipe him out. Wonder how I'd get him to do that. And a spirit comes up and goes, hey, I'll tell you what. I could get him to do it. Oh, really? God says, how could you do that? Well, I'll tell you what. I'll put a lying spirit in the mouths of the prophets. Now, you got to understand, there's already a prophet in Malachi who had gave a prophecy to Ahab. Says, you go fight those guys, you lose. Ahab throws him in prison. Now, watch. How does the spirit get the other prophets to lie? The guy said, you losing's in prison. I think I'm going to say you win. All they had to do is get him to look at the guy who was in prison. Using their own selfish desire for self-preservation, they lie to Ahab, say he's going to win, he goes to war, gets killed, and so on. Okay? Notice in both cases, the enemy, Satan and the spirits, jumped headfirst into God's plan. They were so stupid. God didn't do those things. But he knows Satan's nature. He knows your nature. He knows human nature. Did you know in Deuteronomy 8:18, he tells Israel, I have given you the power to get wealth. He didn't say, I gave you wealth. I gave you the power to get wealth. Your wealth is going to come. I'm going to use you to get your own. Yeah. Okay. I want you to understand that the things that are happening in our world today, including the nasty C word and the mask and all that stuff that you see, the inflation you see, the riots you see, not one of them are outside of God's plan. The enemy is moving exactly in line where God wants him to go. He doesn't force him to do it. He just knows his nature is to steal, kill, and destroy. He knows your nature. He knows your nature for self-preservation. He knows how your desire for freedom and liberty. So he's got those family members on Facebook that you get in those arguments right now about liberty and freedom with. Or on the other side, he gets you arguing about your safety and should you get a shot, wear a mask, not wear a mask. I'm not given either side of that. Okay, God knows us. He knows our world. The world is moving the direction, the universe is moving the direction God had planned before he ever said, let there be light. God has a plan. Nothing you will ever do, nothing Satan will ever do, nothing the Democratic Party will do or the Republican Party will do, that the economists will do or the stock market will do. None of those things will ever thwart God's plan. So you might as well look at it instead of whining and griping about it. I've been guilty of it. Saying, God, ooh, I am excited to see about what you're doing. Because I know right now I might be falsely accused of Potiphar's wife. I know right now I might be in prison and I interpreted those guys' dreams. But I know right now they're plotting to kill all the Jewish people. But God, now I'm going to put it this way. I'm going to use the words given to Esther. Just maybe, you were born in this time, at this time, to live in this time by the appointment of God. Just maybe. What has he appointed you to do? But you will lose track of that if you don't recognize he's in charge of it all. And then the last thing, if you don't recognize God's providence concurrence, you will have difficulty not falling into theism. That is, God created the universe, wound it up like a clock, and there it goes. Gravity does its thing, time does its thing, science does its thing, and God just stands back and watches it. Not a good place to go. God wants to work his plan through you. Does he have to? Uh-uh. He invites me into that. Doesn't force me, but he knows me. I get to be a part of what God's doing in the world today. Please stand.
This is Pastor Randy Reams, and I want to thank you for joining us today for Truths from God's Unchanging Word. This broadcast is a ministry outreach of Kindred Bible Church in Nampa, Idaho. And if you'd like to hear this message in its entirety or other messages, just visit kindredbible.org/media. And there you can also subscribe to the podcast. If you're being ministered to by this broadcast, I'd like to ask you to consider financially supporting this ministry. Giving is easy. Just go to kindredbible.org/give. There you can make a one-time gift, or you can choose to become a monthly supporter. But if you prefer, you can send your gift to KBC, P.O. Box 32, Nampa, Idaho 83653. Your prayers, words of encouragement, and financial support helps ensure that this broadcast will continue to be heard in your region and around the world. Again, I'd like to thank you for listening to Truths from God's Unchanging Word.